Time for Sports Lit 101 as Bruce Pratt is here with us, as he is each and every Wednesday afternoon. Welcome, welcome, Bruce.
Well, it's good to be back, and it's was really interesting. I came across this book only because friends of the show and friend of mine, Jamie Dopp from the University of Victoria, talked about it and emphasizing a certain section of this book in terms of the origins of what will become hockey literature. And what happens, this book is called Glengarry School Days. It was written by a guy who wrote under the name Ralph Connor, but whose real name was Charles William Gordon, and he was a ordained Presbyterian minister. And these stories take place, and this is the only bit of Canadian history we'll talk about, in the era right after Confederation. The provinces of Canada became a confederation in 1867. It's not a time where Americans are spending a lot. I mean, in American history, we don't study that a lot because we're coming out of our own Civil War and going into Reconstruction and the like. But it was the start of what will become modern Canada. And this is a book that when it's reviewed by people who read it today, for the most part, they still think highly of it. I don't as much, but I think that could be a little bit me, but here's what they said about the book when it came out in the first American edition. In a lively, animated style, the author gives us intimate glimpses into the daily lives of the boys who attended the little schoolhouse in Glengarry. But more than a portrayal of happy, carefree boyhood, it is the story of Huey Murray, the minister's son, his exciting adventures and boyish experiences, and on. Now, there's nothing carefree about all of this, because these kids are being brought up in a very male-centric society, adhering to rugged individualism, strict discipline, both corporal and moral discipline. And it's being held up as the way to raise a nation. That if you can raise all the boys to be this way and all the girls to be this way, Canada will become a nation among nations, because they'll all be good, God-fearing people who believe in fair play and the like. Now, it's a novel in stories, and by that I mean people that are familiar with the work of Elizabeth Strout in both Olive Again and Olive Kittredge, and to some extent, my name is Lucy Barton. The chapters may not necessarily be in a linear order. Here they are. But they're more sketches of the lives of these boys and the trials and tribulations. And there's a really good teacher in here and runs, and there's a really horrible teacher that the students actually physically throw out of the school. There's a new sort of jaded teacher who comes in. And at the end of the book, all the older boys have decided they're going to become ministers. Now, it's just that in itself is laughable. But what's really interesting is to look at this as history. People will often say, well, you know, you shouldn't read the Little House on the Prairie books because they're racist. There are people in the books who indeed say things that are racist, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't read the book, because if you don't know these things happened and you don't know they exist, you don't learn what history was about. If you try and whitewash history, make sure that nobody reads anything unpleasant or reads anything that might offend them, what's the point of having literature? As former President Eisenhower said when people were trying to ban books, he said, you don't want to ban books, go read every book in the library. The book can't hurt you. Right? That's not what's going to hurt you. And as I was reading this, I was thinking about how this really plays into sports lit as an academic area, an academic discipline. Because the last section of the book involves three of the last four chapters involve a game of shinny. Now, shinny was the way hockey was played before a puck was used and a ball was used. And the hockey stick was more like an Irish hurley club. And you played on skates, and there were two sides, and there was no exact rule about how many people were on each team. What eventually happened to change hockey, they were codified around 1920, were what were called the Montreal Rules. And that's when you got down to the number of players that we have today. The rules were not the same as they are today, but they were what changed. Shinny, like a game called Bandy, which was played on large lakes, could have any number of people in any size area and a goal at each end. The book would have you believe that any boy could skate. They all could skate. They all could hunt. They all could do these things. And the shinny game becomes a metaphor for how to be Canadian. If someone whacks you in the shin and breaks your leg, you just go to the goal and become the goalkeeper while the goalkeeper takes your place. You don't retaliate. You don't play in anything dirty. You don't you don't try and seek revenge. You just try and win the game as an honorable gentleman. Now that sounds absurd to modern day people, and I think it should. But what's really fascinating, I found in reading this, is if you look back at many, many, many of the books in that muscular Christianity era from the late 19th century on into the sort of Horatio Alger stories of the 20th century, you follow books that have to do with sports heroes, the Frank Merriweather books and the like, you see that the hero always chooses to do the right thing, even when it runs counter to what he thinks you should do. And it's almost always a he, which is why I'm using only masculine terms here. The other value in this, though, is to learn how people lived when they came from a place like Scotland to settle in parts of Ontario that were pretty wild, where survival really depended on everybody in the family working every day, where a minister and his wife would not be making enough of a living that they didn't have to do those kinds of things too, have a garden and make some of their own clothes and do those kinds of things. Same thing with a schoolmaster, that it wasn't a job. Well, of course, teaching today is slumped back into this, where the the money would carry somebody through a full year. And also we learn in this book, and it's something I knew, but I think it's easy to forget, that school was very often not a September to June kind of affair, that there would be times where kids would be gone for months at a time to return to school only later on. It wasn't necessary that you had the summer off, because you might be the group of boys that needed to be home in the winter to work in the woods, or to pursue hunting or trapping or something like that. So it's great as a historical novel, giving us a glimpse into the way that the Scots and Scots-Irish of this region live. There are a couple of tropes in here that are very unsettling for me. One is that, of course, the one kid who's always thought to be a little half a bubble off plum, as William Heasley Moon would say, is the one French kid in the area. And he sort of is treated as an oddity. But also what I found astonishing, and you read all these contemporary reviews of this book, oh, it's so wonderful, it does. One of the dogs in the book is named after a terrible racist slur that we would not use on the air about African-Canadian people, African-American people. And the dog's name just keeps coming up in this one thing. And I have not read anyone who's objected to that. Well, here's why. Probably. It's a word that you see in Twain. It's a word that you see in older stories. And it tells you what life was like then. And it tells you how those kinds of things get passed down. No kid is born to hate or to discriminate or to have horrible thoughts in his or her heart about other people. You learn that, right? So if we look back and we see how Canadian identity springs from this, we understand, I think, very clearly all the problems that the Indigenous people of Canada faced with, especially during the areas controlled by the English, who said, you know, well, the sun set on the red man, it's time for us to move in, and that's too bad. So this is a great book for history. It is probably a fairly accurate telling of what life was like then, but more importantly, it really shows you that kind of stiff upper lip way to play sports. It's not for gain or money. The amateur who wouldn't take time to train, you know, you might practice a day or two here or there, but it would be beneath you to make sport this big a thing sports should represent what you are, as opposed to sport helping you become who you could be. And I think that's a very different approach than our side of the border. I think we're more often, we have the kid who needs sports to become a better person, as opposed to the kid who's a better person and then becomes the leader, so everybody else does that in sport. So clearly the Scott Young books, Boy in Defense, Boy in Lease Camp, and all the answers we've talked about since then, Roy McGregor's The Last Season, Lynn Cotagonist, Searching for Terry Punchout, The Good Body by Bill Gaston, all the Terry Allard did Searching for Terry Punchout, and many, many more, is Canada's way, is a literary way of coming to terms with what is phony about hockey being the way you become Canadian. And it's fascinating for me to every year some scholar just go in a different place, finding one more thing about this. So I'm really in debt to Jamie Findus. Now, Ralph Connor wrote 30 books over his career. And what I found was really interesting when I looked at the back cover, Classics of American Boyhood, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer Abroad, Tom Sawyer Detective, Another Story. So Twain is on the back of the first American edition, and the front page is, looks like no place Mark Twain ever lived. It's, you know, it looks like a Currier and Ives drawing of winter at its best. So it's called Glengarry School Days. If you are a historian of sport, or even a historian of sport and identity, it's a really good read. And if you just want to have something you can read in little sections, they're 15, 20 page chapters, to get a feel for another time in another place, Glengarry School Days is worth it. You can probably get it for about $2 or $3 from a Libris or Thrift Books. I don't remember. I didn't pay much more for the hard copy. I think $1.60 maybe. But it opens some windows, opens some eyes.
Nice. Thank you, Bruce. What's coming up next week?
Well, we're probably going to have to go through this in a couple of sections. Friend of the show, Steve Keacher, who put together Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles, a book we talked a lot about, has written an incredible text called Baseball, The Turbulent Mid-Century Years. I have the advanced uncorrected proofs. It's about 630 pages. I just started it. The people who have talked about it and written about it say it's just a phenomenal book. It's full of wonderful photographs, but it's about baseball in the mid-century, when baseball's really changing. We were talking about this the other week about how Smokey Joe Wood is like that cog that gets you to Ruth and Gehrig and has you with Cobb and Speaker and all that. And from that period of time until Jackie Robinson comes in to Curt Flood and free agency, that may be the most turbulent time in baseball in many ways. So I've just started reading, and I'm really excited. I think we'll probably try and do it in 150 or 200 page segments, because there ain't a whole lot of white space. But Steve is a wonderful writer, and I'm sure it's going to be very good.
Excellent. Looking forward to that. Thank you, Bruce.
Too. My pleasure.
Sports Lit 101 every Wednesday right here on Downtown.